Bon, je vous propose de vous asseoir. Nous allons commencer le séminaire. Et nous avons vraiment le très grand privilège aujourd'hui d'accueillir Alfonso Caramazza, qui vient spécialement pour nous de Harvard. I'll switch to English to introduce you, Alfonso. Thank you very much for being here for us. Alfonso has been working on language representations in the brain for all of his career. I cited your work last year, I think the 1975 paper, which was on the neuropsychology of aphasia, and which really turned the tables for aphasia. So Alfonso has been working as a cognitive neuropsychologist for all these years, looking at the effect of lesions in the brain, and is extremely renowned for his particular stance on the need to analyze single cases of brain lesion patients. That was also a turning point for cognitive neuropsychology. Alfonso, you are still directing the Cognitive Neuropsychology Laboratory in Harvard, but you are also turned to brain imaging, like all of us, as a complementary tool to look at the organization of brain structures. And today you're going to tell us about the organization of syntactic categories. How is syntactic category organization performed by the brain? Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. Can you hear me? Can you hear me? Thank you for this introduction. Stan just mentioned that some years ago I started to champion the need to do single patient analyses. Well, I was anticipated by at least 150 years. You, I'm sure, all know that Claude Bernard, the founder of modern physiology, used to only do single subject analysis. He objected to the averaging of data unless there was a real reason for averaging. And there's a beautiful book by Georges Canguilhem, Le pathologique et le normal, that discusses the birth of modern physiology and the role of Claude Bernard in this work. So yes, we do single case studies, but we didn't invent them. They are part of the long history in a field. I apologize, I'm going to sit so I'll be closer to my slides. I am going to discuss something. Some of the things I'm going to talk about are familiar to you, but I'm going to try and talk about them in any case because I want to develop an argument as part of looking at these data. The point I'm going to make is that it is extremely difficult, if not to say meaningless, to look at brain data unless one has a very well-articulated theory of what one is looking for. The massive data we collect now with imaging is simply very gross. It is something at a level that can only give us a very blurry view of how the brain is organized. And to be able to sharpen the view, we need to have well-worked out theories of what the mind looks like. Now, you've all seen this very famous sentence on a particular statistical count. It is the most frequently used sentence in the English language. But I'm sure that those of you who see this for the first time will say this is a nonsensical sentence. It's nonsensical, but nonetheless, it is a well-formed sentence of English. And Noam Chomsky, who first wrote and perhaps uttered this sentence, was trying to make a point, a simple point that I think has been coming through. I missed the whole lecture that Stan Dehan gave, but I'm sure he emphasized the role of structure and how structure operates over particular objects that are defined in terms of features or properties that are not strictly speaking semantic or conceptual. The sentence, colorless green ideas sleep furiously, is nonsensical. The meanings of the words that are composed together don't make any sense. And yet, we have no trouble recognizing this as a sentence. And this has given rise to the notion that we should distinguish between syntax, the computations we carry out that specify how words can be strung together to construct meanings, and the actual building blocks, semantic blocks, that must be put together to compose those meanings. So the important point here is that what we're looking at is this structure And these symbols that allow us to string together words of the language to make sentences. Now, some of you, and I know some people are not particularly enamored of Chomsky because of some of his views about the modularity of some of these components, might be convinced if instead of using Chomsky to produce a sentence of this type, we were to have a patient to produce it. So here's a neuropsychological bit of evidence. A patient was asked to describe this picture and was required to start the sentence with the word "the box," and then to complete the sentence with a sentence that the patient thought described this picture. I don't know if this is legible in the back, and I apologize, it may be small, but what the patient wrote is, "The box has been negated by the misused staff." Now, I think that all of you will recognize immediately the similarity to Chomsky. Now, I don't want to say Chomsky was brain damaged to produce the sentence, but clearly you can disrupt the semantic system independently of the rules that bind words together to make well-formed sentences. So the analysis of brain damaged patients can be used to inform, if you will, the biologically defensible partitions of a system of interest to us. In this case, language, we can find out what are the elements, what are the components that make up this very complicated system we call language. Let me give you another example to go a little bit further with this analogy. A patient is asked to describe this picture, and the patient says, "The bazods was shining over the sun." Now, again, you all recognize this as a plausible sentence of English. It has all the reasonable elements, including a bound morpheme, ing. What is striking about this is that the patient's difficulties in articulating words was restricted to only a subset of the words of the language. And that subset is well-defined in the sense that it makes sense in a theoretical framework. The elements that the patient has difficulties producing are those elements we call open class words. Those words that can be replenished, and as you know, with new scientific revolutions and technological revolutions, our dictionary, our vocabulary expanded immensely. All those expansions have occurred at the level of nouns and verbs and perhaps adjectives, but not this particular types of words that play a more grammatical role in the sentence. So again, we find that the brain can cleave apart, can separate those elements that have a role in syntactic processing, if you will, from those that have a role perhaps in carrying a different kind of meaning. It is not that syntax doesn't carry meaning, it is that individually the words that make up a sentence, nouns and verbs, have meanings, whereas the grammatical features have a very abstract meaning, if you will. So if you start with the working assumption that language is simply a system of words and rules, we can quickly see that we can distinguish different types of elements in a sentence. So in the simple sentence, "The boy likes the koalas," we can see that "likes" and "koalas" both have a morpheme, the S, but this morpheme has a different role as a function of whether it is attached to a noun or attached to a verb. In one case, it specifies agreement. In one case, it specifies number. So these operations, these morphosyntactic morphological operations, seem to operate over elements of a particular type, and these elements are nouns and verbs. So nouns and verbs then play a very important role in the construction of sentences and in the construction, the building of meanings. So the question that comes, what distinguishes these two types of words? How are they processed and represented in the brain? Is there some way in which these words can be shown to be distinguished at a neural level? Now, obviously, there must be. If we have to use these distinctions to compute meanings, then the brain must somehow capture these differences, and the question is, how? And as I said, one important source of evidence comes from the processing deficits in brain-damaged subjects. Now, Those of you who are interested in more historical aspects of science will may know that Giambattista Vico already anticipated us many years ago when he wrote, "There's a good man living among us who, after a severe apoplectic stroke, utters nouns but has completely forgotten verbs." So here we have already in 1745 a clear distinction between two types of words, and Linnaeus, not to be outdone by Vico, describes a case of amnesia for all nouns, proper names in particular. So we have this beautiful double dissociation already described many centuries ago. And more recently, I like to use this example from one of my patients, because when I first heard this patient, basically my life changed. I became interested in studying this distinction. The patient asked to describe this picture. I think you can all see produced beautifully well-formed sentences. "Oh Lordy, she's making a mess. She let the thing go and is getting on the floor. They're stealing something. He's falling. He's going to hurt himself. She's cleaning these things. She's looking at him falling and she's going to get some of the stuff he's giving her." If you're looking at the picture, you have no problem understanding what the patient is saying. If you take away the picture, you have no idea what the patient is saying. And the reason is that the patient, instead of producing nouns, would produce pronouns, or very general words that indicate objects. It is as if the patient has difficulties in retrieving nouns, but not verbs. The verbs are there and they're perfectly fine. And he has a contrasting patient who has difficulties in producing verbs, but there's one important difference between these two. They both have trouble with one type of word class. In one case, the difficulty doesn't disrupt the syntactic flow. So here, missing nouns doesn't hurt too much. However, when you have difficulty producing verbs, all of a sudden, the sentence structure is disordered. And that's because verbs play a crucial role in gluing together the words into a sentence. So you think of it as the predicate and nouns as the arguments. If you don't have a predicate, you don't know what kinds of arguments to put in, how to organize those arguments. Now, this work has been quantified and in a paper with my colleague Gabriele Micheli, we first quantified and reported this observation and associated the difficulties in producing nouns and verbs with two different types of aphasias. Difficulties in producing verbs tend to be associated with this fluent speech, involving primarily frontal lesions, and difficulties in producing nouns tend to be associated with a disorder called anomia, with lesions typically in the temporal lobes. Now, we all get excited when we see this distinction between nouns and verbs, and we say, well, here we have found a distinction between nouns and verbs. Unfortunately, it's not that simple. And the reason is that even though we can say that they are the grammatical categories of nouns and verbs, these words don't come without baggage. Nouns tend to be words of a particular sort. They tend to be objects, entities, concrete, have strong sensory properties, they're imageable. And verbs, although they may have some of these properties, generally tend to involve actions or relations, they're abstract, they're functional, non-imageable. So when we find a dissociation between these two word types, we don't know that in fact we're looking at a grammatical deficit. We could be looking at some other kind of deficit, a semantic deficit, and in fact, the major view in the field has been that this distinction is between a deficit in producing actions and a deficit in producing objects. But of course, we all know that nouns are not objects, certainly not all nouns are, and verbs are not actions, certainly not all verbs are actions. And so this distinction, noun and verb, we should be able to distinguish it, we should be able to find whether we are truly looking at nouns or we're looking at verb deficits. And so there are two hypotheses that have been entertained. And one is that the disorders that we call grammatical are actually semantic conceptual, and that this means that grammatical category deficits will always be linked to a semantic deficit. And this alternative view says that Lexical processing accounts can be given for this disorder, and grammatical category deficits need not be linked to semantic deficits. So we can look then at these patients and see if we can find out. Now, this is not easy again, and it's not easy because it is not as if we can simply go and query the brain where are the words. Because when we use words, we use them in context. And there are many, many processes that go on simultaneously, including the retrieval of the word. And so we have to find ways of converging on what other people have called a functional architecture of a system in order to be able to identify the place at which any effect can be found. The behavior we observe, the results we observe, are a complex result of many, many factors playing together to produce the behavior. The trick is, or the hard part is, to identify exactly where in that system we find this effect, but to be able to say that, we have to have an idea of what the system looks like. So you can't look at verbs or nouns without making some theoretical statement about the organization of the lexical system as a whole. That is a necessary step in order to be able to make advances, not only in neuropsychology, but in neuroimaging, whatever. So, the effort then to study nouns and verbs requires at least three elements. It requires that we specify the components of a process, or if you will, a task analysis, that make up the system that we use to be able to address, to speak, to use words. We have to make some claim about the types of representations, the kind of information that is encoded, and this will be done within specific architectures. You cannot simply say there is such and such a representation unless the architecture as a whole can entertain such a representation. And so your job is to specify the representation types along with the architecture in which it's embedded. And of course, the dynamics of processing. We process information dynamically, and some of the deficits we observe need not reflect deficits in the structure itself, but perhaps in the ways in which the information is processed, how quickly we forget information, how easy it is to access information stored in a part of the brain. So all of these things have to be considered. And what I'm going to do for the rest of this lecture is to first articulate a view of a model of the lexical system, and then show you how recent neuroimaging results can be interpreted in the context of an articulated model of the lexical system, and why perhaps we have been looking at the wrong place or in the wrong way at how the brain organizes grammatical class information. And that, I will argue, follows from the neuropsychological information. So to put everyone on the same page, I'm going to start with an extremely simple claim, a simple model, the simplest model you can imagine, at least in terms of what levels of representation or analysis you will need. So to be able to name this object, you have to be able to recognize it. You have to be able to recognize it as a particular kind of object, the object with this, in this case an ant, and this will allow you to retrieve a lexical item, ant in English, formica in Italian, in French, formi, it's much similar to formica. And then, of course, you have to come up with the segments that articulates, allows you to articulate that word. So can we localize then the effects? And how do we localize the effects? Well, one way in which we localize the effects is to consider the nature of the errors the patients produce. So let me show you two types of errors. Patients are asked to name objects, pictures, and one patient produces 63% correct responses and makes many errors, but all the errors the patient makes, aside from these other, which I will not just get into, are phonological errors. So the patient might try and pronounce glass and might come up with the word blush or glove. Okay? You know that the patient is trying to say glass, and the output is a deformation, a phonological deformation of the target response. So we can localize the problem at this level of the system. Now look at these patients, KEPW and RGB. These patients perform about the same level of performance as patient DM in terms of correct performance, but all of the errors that they make are essentially semantic errors. So they may say bottle for glass or drink for glass. they are producing an error that can be localized somewhere over here, but definitely not here. So we can now look at these patients who make these errors, and then we can query these patients about what it is that we may want to know about, say, grammatical category. So one way in which we can localize the level of at which a deficit occurs in an architecture is in terms of the distribution and types of errors that they make. Okay. So we can look further at these errors, and we can, over here, we cannot say for sure whether the problem that these errors are semantic in nature due to a semantic deficit or due to a lexical deficit. Let me explain this. I apologize for this rather getting you all of this information all at once. You can make an error. You can mistakenly say bottle when you're trying to say glass, not because you didn't understand that it was glass, but because you cannot retrieve the word glass, and a related word, in this case bottle, comes to mind and you can produce it. So that deficit may reflect a problem at the level of retrieval of the word and not at the level of semantics. To distinguish these two types of difficulties, here's another way to look at the data. So we have patients, RGB, who makes semantic errors in oral naming and oral reading. In other words, when the patient has to speak a word, but makes no semantic errors when the patient is writing. Now, from this, we can infer that the patient's semantic system must be intact. The problem is not a problem of meaning, it's a problem of retrieving a lexical item, in this case, a lexical item in a particular type of lexical system in writing. And patient SGD shows the opposite pattern, forcing us to conclude, again, that the semantic system is intact and the difficulty is in retrieving a word in the system. Okay, so this allows us then to make claims about to identify what the nature of the deficit, if it's a grammatical or a semantic one. And what I'm going to do now is very briefly show you the ways in which we can inform such a theory of how the grammatical system is organized in the brain. And I will begin with two types of deficits. One is called modality-specific grammatical class effects. This is patients who have a deficit for nouns or for verbs, but only in the context of demonstrably intact semantics, and they are modality specific, and I'll show you in a moment. And the second type of deficit is, or the same type of task, is if we can demonstrate that the patient's difficulties are specifically morphosyntactic in nature. That is, they specifically involve dealing with words as grammatical objects. So here's an example of a patient with a modality-specific deficit, and I'm afraid this won't be legible in the back, so I will read it. A patient is asked to describe this picture, and one time the patient is asked to speak what the patient is seeing, and the patient says the boy is climbing the fence, perfectly fine. At another time, the patient is asked to write this a description of this picture, and the patient writes the boy blank defense. The patient's difficulty is in retrieving a word of one grammatical class, but only in one modality of output. Okay. Now, you can actually quantify this, you can do all kinds of beautiful experiments because languages have homonyms, that is, words that sound the same and are spelled the same. But they have different grammatical roles in different contexts. So you can have the patient read the sentence, this sentence, I like to play very much, silently, or read the sentence, I like to play the piano, and is asked to pronounce play in both cases. The item pronounced is phonologically identical, they're pronounced exactly the same way, they're written the same way, but in one case one is speaking a noun, in one case one is speaking a verb. We can also have the patient write the word play. We dictate the sentence, I like to play very much, write play. We give the patient a sentence fragment like this with a blank, and the patient is asked to write play. In one case, the patient is writing a verb. In one case, the patient is writing a noun. And we look at the performance of the patient, and we find something really striking. That is, what we find is that patient HW had difficulties in speaking verbs, but not in writing verbs. And notice that when the patient has trouble speaking the verb, it's not because the word is difficult, because the patient can produce that word orally when it's a noun. And the patient, as JD, shows the reverse dissociation by modality. Again, difficulty in this case in writing the verb, but not in speaking it. But it's not because the patient cannot write that verb, because that word can be written, orthographically can be produced, when it's a noun. So what this shows is that we can localize the deficit, not at the semantic level, because the semantics is intact to produce the word in one modality, not at the output level, because the output item is identical in the two cases, but at the level where the grammatically specified word has to be produced, has to be accessed. I will just show you in 2 minutes many other examples. Many patients we've studied. This is a patient who shows a double dissociation within patient. The patient has trouble producing nouns when speaking, but in writing verbs when writing. You quantify this, and what you find is the patient has trouble in speaking nouns relative to verbs, and has trouble writing verbs relative to nouns. So it's within patient, so this cannot be explained other than by a difficulty with the items as they are grammatically specified, and not for any other account is possible. I like to show this because those of you who study or have an interest in progressive disorders, here's a patient that R.G. Hillis studied many years ago now. Well, this many years ago. The patient is asked to write nouns, and over a 2.5 year period, the patient behaved at around 90% level of accuracy in writing nouns. In writing verbs, the patient's performance was essentially the same as writing nouns, about 90%. In speaking nouns, the patient was, again, pretty much consistent across 2.5 years of testing. But in speaking verbs, the patient could not speak verbs. Already at the onset, when we started testing the patient 8 years after the onset, the patient was at difficulty with verbs, and over time, the patient became incapable of producing any verbs at all. Okay, so clearly then, we can have modality-specific disorders for words of one grammatical category, and this allows us to, with some level of certainty, say that the deficit must be occurring at a level where the word is specified grammatically and not at a semantic level and not at a segmental level of production. And for those of you who are interested on the possibility that these, what we're looking at is just some strange adaptations of patients to a deficit, these deficits can be found 6 years after the stroke. So we test the patient 6 years after the stroke. Patient shows a difficulty in writing verbs relative to writing nouns. And the patient was scanned 1 hour after the test. We found a small acute subcortical infarct and a large area of perfusion in left posterior inferior frontal gyrus, inferior precentral and postcentral gyri and insula. Here it is. The patient was reperfused, I don't know if it was given aspirin or blood pressure was elevated, I don't know, and performance returned up for the writing of verbs. So you can see that these grammatical class difficulties for a modality are not the mere consequence of a strange adaptation of the system to damage, but they are part of the actual architecture of the system. We can also look, and this is the last neuropsychological data I will show you, we can also look at tasks that involve morphosyntactic processing specifically. And we ask whether the deficit is specifically a morphosyntactic one, that there's a deficit in processing the word as a noun or a verb. And we do this by looking at how the words are modified in particular sentential contexts. So here is there are two patients, patient JR and patient RC, who are asked to name pictures of objects and actions and so on. And the patient RC had more difficulty in producing verbs, and patient JR had more difficulty in producing nouns. So we have the dissociation I've been talking about. Okay? We now test the patient with a task, sometimes called the WAGS test, because of an experimental design that was developed by Gene Berko-Gleason with Roger Brown at Harvard in 1958. And this is a very simple task. This was used with children primarily at the beginning. The patient is given a sentence, this is a guide, then is given a fragment, these are, and the patient is supposed to complete the sentence. These are guides. So now the patient is producing a noun and producing the right morphology for that noun. These are sales. This is sale. The patient has produced the right morphophonological transformation, in this case, the deletion or the removal of the morpheme S. You can do this for verbs. This person guides. They're the same words, they're homonyms. This person sale. Again, you perform the same phonological alternation. And you can do this with pseudo words. This is a flea. These are, and a native speaker of English, answer very quickly, fleaves. These are wags. This is a wag. Okay? You can have these as verbs. This pig fleaves. These pigs fleave, and so on. And you can ask then, how do these patients perform this task? And what you find is that they show the same pattern of grammatical class difficulty. In performing this morphosyntactic operation, a morphophonological operation, they are impaired for words of one grammatical class. Note that the phonology is identical, right? These are homonyms. They're producing plays correctly when they're discussing a noun, say, but they cannot say plays when you say he plays. So the difficulty must be related in a transformation, a morphosyntactic transformation of a particular lexical entry. Now, this morphosyntactic deficit is not a mere consequence of a semantic impairment, because we know that there are patients who have trouble at the semantic level in producing nouns and verbs who do not show the morphosyntactic deficit. So here's a patient, HG, that Kevin Shapiro and I studied some years ago now, who makes errors in producing nouns and verbs in naming them, but makes absolutely no errors in producing a morphosyntactic alternation. That is, the difficulties are not the result of a semantic deficit. When you damage the morphosyntactic process, you can do so independently, or it can be spared independently of the semantic system. Okay, so why all of this? Because we have to try and localize now where lexicographical effects can occur. What is the lexical architecture within which we're going to find these kinds of deficits, these kinds of information? So given then the existence of modality-specific grammatical class dissociations, the one where you have difficulties in producing words of one grammatical category in one type of modality, speaking or writing, and the morphosyntactic processing deficits do not depend on semantic damage, this data I've just shown you, we can conclude that the lexical system is comprised of independent phonological and orthographic lexical components. And this is a fairly radical view, each connected directly to semantic and morphosyntactic components. So this is the simple model I presented. We're going to have to make it a little bit more complicated. And the complication is very interesting. The complication says that we have an orthographic lexicon, a phonological lexicon, and these lexicon components are accessed directly from semantics, and they interact with a morphosyntactic process to produce a word of a particular grammatical category. I will, at the end, show you another slide that shows this more clearly. But here I'm using an idea which I didn't know at the time had been proposed by Halley and Marantz that is called distributed morphology, which claims that nouns and verbs are not specified as such directly in the lexicon. Nouns and verbs are computed online when we produce words in particular grammatical contexts. And in this model that I proposed in 97, the morphosyntax is accessed both by certain semantic features I will discuss in a moment, as well as directly by a phonological lexicon and orthographic lexicon. This view is radically different. Doesn't seem radical, but it's amazingly radical when you think about the complications that are introduced in terms of processing characteristics from the classical model in psycholinguistics, in linguistics, which says that we first activate a semantic representation, which then specifies a syntactically specified lexical form, abstract lexical form, and then this abstract syntactically specified form will activate either a phonological lexeme or an orthographic lexeme. I've argued in various papers that this theory cannot be right because it could not produce semantic errors that are modality specific, at least as formulated in these theories. Okay, so it's much more complicated than I've made it sound, but what I get to you is the main idea that that we have to reconsider the functional architecture so we can now look inside and see what neuroimaging information can tell us. The reason is that brain damage cases are amazingly useful when it comes to trying and learn something about the functional architecture of the lexical system. But the brain damage that, unless you're really lucky and you work with Laurent Cohen and he gets to find these patients who have a tiny little part of the brain that's been removed for a tumor and then it produces a word form deficit, most of the patients that I've studied in the past, have rather large lesions. And these are the two patients I showed you before, RC and JR. JR has difficulties in producing nouns. And RC is different producing verbs. It's very difficult to know why these two patients with these lesions have these kinds of deficits. You're going to have to go to a different method. You shouldn't let the methods drive your theory. You should let your theory drive the methods you use. And so we've tried to complement this by looking at neuroimaging. Even though I'm not a great lover of neuroimaging at times, I think it has amazing promise, and it's really, you've seen some of the beautiful results that have been presented. I saw some that were discussed this morning with Professor Dehan. So what we did was we tested subjects, these are now intact subjects, with the task that I showed you before, the phonological task. And we used many different types of words. We used real words versus pseudo words. We used the concrete words or abstract words, regular morphology versus irregular morphology. A whole bunch of these items were used. We then looked, we scanned the subject in processing these words, and we found the areas that are activated by the morphophonological ternation task for both nouns and verbs. And you can see the usual suspects light up, left hemisphere, a frontal area, a posterior temporal area lights up. But what is important is to look for those areas that are specifically responsive to nouns versus responsive for verbs. So you look at the contrast between responses to noun items versus verb items. And I will not go into detail because I want to make a general point. But you get two areas that show up that are interesting. You get this posterior temporal area, and you get this inferior in this frontal area that is perhaps a middle temporal gyrus. So we can use then neuroimaging to try and converge on the brain mechanisms, and we can do this by as I said, by looking at various types of tasks. We did this with bilingual subjects, one window, two windows, una ventana, dos ventanas, and we tried to see whether there are differences in how the brains of a Spanish represents nouns and verbs versus English speakers, and we get exactly the same patterns of results for the verb production as we get for the verb production preference for English speakers and Spanish speakers. Again, we get this posterior temporal area, and we get this frontal area showing up for verbs. Why do we get these activations? So these are just spurious activations. And neuroscientists have developed a technique of interference. I don't know if this has been discussed previously by Professor Dehan, but this is a stimulation technique where you interfere with processing. It's called transcranial magnetic stimulation. What you do is apply a magnetic field to the brain, to the skull, and you can localize the effect of this stimulation to a fairly small area. We use the task that I mentioned before. This is a sale. These are sales for different types of words. And what we find is that when you interfere with various types of areas of the brain, the only one that shows a true interference effect is this anterior midfrontal gyrus area. There's a little effect in inferior frontal gyrus, but the primary effect seems to be in this anterior midfrontal gyrus. So yes, when you show the activation in the brain in MRI, it's not just an effect that is correlated with the task. It seems to be a true effect in the sense that if you interfere with it, you produce errors or you disrupt the process. And we have looked at posterior MTG, and our results in posterior MTG have been extremely disappointing in using the morphosyntactic task. We cannot get a noun-verb effect when we stimulate posterior MTG. We only get this effect in anterior MTG. Okay? However, this doesn't mean that MTG doesn't produce nouns and verbs. It does process nouns and verbs when the task involves just a judgment of the word in terms of what it means, in terms of how you use it. We show that in left MTG, we get a great interference effect relative to nouns when the task of the subject is to decide if something like I grasp is a concrete item, the rat is a concrete item, or whether it's an abstract word like I wonder, I ponder as a verb or as a noun. Okay? So it looks like the posterior area is involved in distinguishing nouns and verbs, but not as morphosyntactic objects. So we've tried to see whether it could be an action-object distinction that is represented, that produces the verb effect, and we've done this using MRI, and the answer is no. We do get an effect of action in a posterior part, the very tiny area. What we do find is state verbs produce greater activation than state nouns. So the verb effect is found, but it doesn't seem to be an effect of grammatical category. It is grammatical category, but it doesn't seem to have anything to do with the morphosyntactic process. Okay. We looked at one last property, and here I think we hit the jackpot. We looked at none of the other variables I've mentioned before, but we looked at predication or transitivity. So verbs can be distinguished in terms of whether they're transitive or intransitive. John died, John chased Bill. And this is a semantic syntactic property. It's semantic because it helps specify the predicate structure of the sentence, and it's syntactic because it specifies the kinds of grammatical roles, thematic roles that words can play in a sentence. And what we did was we looked, first of all, at which parts of the brain are activated by verbs relative to nouns, and we find the usual suspect, posterior MTG, and we find this area in inferior frontal and medial frontal gyrus. And then we looked at the activations in these areas, and we took out the effects of many variables, as many variables as we could think of. We covered it out, if you will, the length of the words, how hard it was to respond to these words in the task, the imageability values, the number of senses the words had, the log frequency of the words, telicity, that is whether they have a natural endpoint, like something breaks versus a screen that has no natural endpoint. Dynamicity, how dynamic the verbs are, subject agentivity, intentional verbs versus non-intentional verbs, and predication transitivity. And what we found is, I think, something quite beautiful. We found that some variables do account for the variation in the ball response in these parts of the brain. So reaction time always seems to play a role, a very strong effect. And so this is a cautionary note to all of you who do neuroimaging: covariate out reaction time if you can in your task, because it seems to be a major player in determining the value of the ball response you get. We get another effect of imageability, in this case abstractness, but most importantly what we find is that the only grammatical variable, grammatical syntactic variable, semantic syntactic variable affects the ball responses here is transitivity or predication. Okay, So I can conclude. I'm sure I've confused many of you, but I think it'll become crystal clear, I hope, in a moment why I spent so much time talking about neuropsychological data, and then I rushed through the imaging data. And the conclusion is this. This is a conclusion, and then I will try and articulate it in more detail. Neuropsychological and neuroimaging evidence converge on a theory of the lexical system that is radically different from the classical view. Although we have only a sketch of this theory, it serves as a biologically motivated framework for more detailed explorations of the lexical representations and processes involved in language. If the functional architecture of the system is the one that I said it might be, and not the classical one, then it has tremendous implications for how we interpret neuroimaging data and what we look for neuroimaging data. One implication follows here. So here's the classical view of the lexical system. We have a semantic level of processing. We have a lexical level where items are grammatically specified. Something is a noun or a verb, and then we produce the segments and speak the word. In this theory, looking for nouns and verbs in the brain is a plausible enterprise, is a meaningful enterprise. You can see, you can look, and you can find that there's an area that represents information, verb, and noun. However, if you were to adopt the view that I think is perhaps more reasonable, it's interesting how you first make bold assertions and then words like perhaps creep in when you get to the end, because you see all the difficulties that these models actually involve. Now, on this theory, in the lexical one, the lexical component specifies the phonological forms. These items are not specified for grammatical category. Their grammatical category comes through in a morphosyntactic process that allows them to specify the particular kinds of segments you have to produce. Now, this is true both for speaking, I argue, and it's true for writing as two separate components. But there's one important implication if this theory is right. You're not going to find an area that represents nouns and verbs. What you're going to find is an area that represents the morphosyntactic processes that produce nouns and verbs. And you may be able to dissociate that area from areas that represent information that ultimately gets represented as a noun or a verb. Okay? But you're not going to find an area that represents verbs. What you're going to find, perhaps, is the kind of semantic information that helps specify the grammatical categories you need to use, things like predication, but not the specifics of an item, that a glass is made of in a particular shape, or that glass is made of a substance that is non-porous. That kind of semantic information, or some people will call conceptual information, doesn't play a role in determining whether something is a noun or a verb. It is only information of a very abstract nature, such as the ones that we've been saying, such as predication, that helps shape this. So if we were to look in the brain for the kinds of information that determines what something is a noun or a verb, you're not going to find it. And in fact, many years of trying to find this failed. We tried all the variables we could think of that could account for why we get a noun-verb difference, and we never found a difference except for this last item. So the concluding representation that I propose is something that, as I say here with some trepidation, says that morphosyntactic processes and morphological processes are probably represented in this anterior area, and some of the evidence we've presented would suggest that, such as, for example, the TMS research. The predicate semantic information is represented in some posterior part of the temporal lobe or perhaps parts of the parietal lobe. And argument semantics may be represented in a more temporal lobe. And these items interact, systems interact with this frontal area to produce what we end up calling nouns and verbs. Okay. So it's not that I'm going back on the claim I made at the beginning in terms of nouns and verbs being fundamental building blocks for sentence construction. What I'm going back on is the claim that this grammatical distinctions are represented the brain directly in the lexical system. Rather, what I'm saying is, as I said, consistent with the view that's advocated by Halley and Marantz, that we actually compute these grammatical objects in the process of building up sentences. And this question about where verbs are represented was already asked many years ago by St. Jerome, and Hugh van Clevis pointed out correctly right here. And I'd like to thank my collaborators for helping me. Thank you.